Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What do you want from me?
Remember Ben Parker? The old man you shot down in cold blood?
What does it matter to you anyway?
Everything!
So that was Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker seeking vengeance in the New York City subway system in Spider-Man 3. The movie is still breaking records at the box office, $800 million worldwide since its release 2 weeks ago. Wow. And you might say that the studios are getting their own revenge on the critics who broadly panned the film. So do moviegoers listen to the reviewers anymore? We will ask that question now as we preview the summer movies with two film critics. We will also look at some of the indie films worth catching and take your recommendations in a little while on what not to miss that's newly released. So with me for this are Owen Gleiberman, film critic for Entertainment Weekly, and Dana Stevens, who reviews films for Slate.com. Owen, welcome back to WNYC, and Dana, welcome.
Thanks, Brian.
Hi, glad to be here, Brian.
Dana, in your review of Spider-Man, you wrote, "The critics could condemn Spider-Man 3 in one thundering chorus, and we'd sound like a few sorry crickets chirping to the hordes who will line up to see it." Is this an acknowledgement that moviegoers just don't care what you think?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And yet here I am chirping away on the radio with my movie opinion.
That's right.
I mean, there's these summer movies that are called critic-proof, and I think some of the big ones, you know, that we're probably going to talk about today, including Spider-Man 3 and Pirates of the Caribbean 3, are among them.
So certain movies, Owen, are critic-proof and others aren't?
Well, you know, I sort of disagree with that idea. First of all, I've never thought that the main purpose of critics is to steer people to this movie or to that movie. If you look through movie history, tons of films have been blockbusters that the critics haven't liked. I think what we serve is to comment on these films and sort of have a conversation about them. I get very excited when I'm writing about blockbusters, even if I know that in the case of Spider-Man 2, I was pretty mixed on it. I know that people are going to go anyway. And yet I think people get so excited about these films that when they come out, they really want to read what critics have to say about them.
It's interesting. It's an interesting interpretation of your role. And you might say this is the summer of sequels. Another one out today is Shrek the Third. Let's hear a clip from that film.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
And you.
And you.
Any thoughts on Shrek the Third, Owen?
I haven't seen Shrek, so I'll pass that on to Dana.
Dana, have
you? I was going to bounce that one to you, Owen.
Uh-oh.
It just opened today. I didn't review it, and I haven't seen it either.
All right, so one for the kids, obviously. And then the question always is this fun enough for the adults tagging along? And do they try to aim them that way?
You know, that's certainly what they've done with the Shrek films. I mean, I loved both of the first two, and I thought the second one was surprisingly good. The first one was kind of a classic fairy tale, but the second one was just loaded with jokes, and I think that the makers of these animated films have become extremely shrewd at aiming them both at adults and kids. It's ultimately a business decision to do that. They figured out a way to make adults kind of happy to go to these films, even a lot of adults who don't have kids. So they're playing to two demographics, and at the same time, doing that results in a more satisfying movie. I mean, I really look forward to at least the Pixar films. I'm going to see Shrek the Third this weekend, and I'm quite looking forward to it.
Dana, have we crossed a kind of historic threshold with sequels? Wasn't there a time where they were destined to languish at the box office, but maybe around, I don't know, Terminator 2 in the 90s or something, the historic fates of sequels changed?
Yeah, I don't know if that's exactly where you date it, but it's certainly true that if anything now, I mean, obviously from the money-making point of view, everybody's looking for a franchise, and, you know, every big movie is looking to set itself up for a series. But it almost seems that people get more excited with each new sequel. I mean, I have to agree with Owen that, you know, I mean, our role may not be to get people into the box office, you know, and when it comes to summer movies, we may be ineffective in that respect. But, you know, the sequel has become an event in and of itself, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
You're the consumer reports for moviegoers, aren't you?
I think
should
Owen
I spend my money here, or should
that,
I spend my...
role.
What?
I think Owen was precisely chafing at that role, and I tend to do the same, maybe. The idea that, you know, we're here to sort of, you know, send people into or away from the box office. I think actually that there's a conversation, you know, a cultural conversation that's between audiences and critics and box office, and, you know, it's all part of the game.
I do think that critics can function as consumer guides as well. I mean, I think it's always been a dual function to do that and to have the conversation. And I don't think that, despite the fact that, I mean, look, Spider-Man is a very successful movie, but it's partly because it wasn't really that bad. I had mixed feelings about it, but I've seen a lot worse. I think when you look at the slate of films for this summer, it sort of shows you the way movie culture has changed even in the last 4 or 5 years. I think back then, if we had had a summer with this many sequels, there would have been a certain amount of cynical eye-rolling on the part of the media. Now what you have is a summer not just of a lot of sequels, but all these part threes. There seem to have been some kind of karmic alignment that all the part threes come out this summer. There's literally like 7 or 8 of them. Right. Rush Hour 3, Spider-Man 3,
yeah.
Ocean's 13, next Bourne Supremacy film.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think that would be an absolute reason to be completely cynical about what Hollywood's doing. Yet you don't hear any of that. On the one hand, I think it's because we've all sort of learn to stop worrying and love the blockbuster and just accept that we live in this franchise world where these sequels are going to be made and what audiences want, and maybe critics do have very little effect.
And so,
at the same time, they've really learned how to make a better blockbuster. A lot of these films are made by very good filmmakers. I remember back in the 80s, part threes of a series would almost always be duds. Something like Poltergeist 3 was beneath contempt. At this point, though, they're aiming very high. They're really trying to make these movies good.
But let me ask you about
one
movie in this respect, and talk about a franchise film, the third in the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, which I gather made over $1 billion worldwide in the second part, is just out. And I read that film had a release date before it had a script. So why isn't that a formula for bad quality, Owen?
Well, they shot the third Pirates film along with the second. And you can say, okay, well, that's sort of cynical, and that's all been arranged, and it's just kind of a business arrangement. On the other hand, that was the exact way that the Lord of the Rings films were shot. They were all shot at the same time. They had those release dates way arranged. Okay, I guess they did have their script ahead of time. But in a sense, you can argue that they're really just being more honest about what they've always done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they know that this movie's going to do well. They know there's going to be a sequel to it, so they've arranged the release date.
But come on,
back in the days before they did that, they were just waiting for the opening weekend anyway to give the go-ahead.
Dana, anything on this?
Well, you know, the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise does have one thing going for it that I think is that's going to keep this movie afloat, so to speak, which is Johnny Depp's character and his performance. And I have a feeling that however weak the script may be, however dependent it may have been on the previous two films, and I know that the way I felt about Pirates 2 was that it was one of those very long, drawn-out, middle-of-a-trilogy-feeling movies where you had to care about the first part and wait for the third part in order to care about the second. It does have Johnny Depp with this strange, sexually ambiguous pirate character who just, I think, has a real fascination and appeal. So I'm looking forward to the movie for that.
And talk about franchises and drawing older folks in. Keith Richards makes a cameo, I understand, as the father of Johnny Depp in this. All right, another sequel, and this is a gift that keeps on giving for the studios. Harry Potter, this time Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. Let's hear some of it and get your reactions.
It's changing over there. There's a storm coming, Harry. Just like last time.
And my guests, Dana Stevens, movie reviewer for Slate.com, Owen Gleiberman, film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Dana, this is Harry's fifth cinematic year at Hogwarts. Anything special about this one?
Well, the fifth movie in a series, you know, it feels like it's really hard to do anything fresh, but these Harry Potter movies have remarkably gotten, you know, essentially better with each installment and have sort of created a world of their own, which is very faithful to the books, but, you know, has its own kind of laws and logic as well. The most exciting thing about The Order of the Phoenix to me is the casting of the villain, Imelda Staunton, who most people here in the U.S. know as Vera Drake from the great Mike Lee movie of that name a couple years ago, is just brilliantly cast as the sadistic, fascistic headmaster at Hogwarts. So I'm looking forward to her role.
Owen?
Well, I have a different view of the Harry Potter films than a lot of people. I agree with Dana that they've gotten better. I especially like the third one, directed by Alfonso Cuarón. But my feeling is that the Harry Potter books are infinitely better than the movies, and in a way quite different. What's so wonderful about those books is that they create a realistic world in which magic happens. And all of the movies seem to be kind of top-heavy with magic. I think they create this purely magical world with little bits of realism sort of shoved in. So I actually think that none of these movies has truly captured what's magical about those books.
Has there ever been a book and a movie where we don't say the book was better than the movie?
Maybe The Godfather.
I want to invite our listeners to call in when we continue with Owen Gleiberman and Dana Stevens. We'll play a little clip from the long-awaited first-ever Simpsons movie. It's amazing that it took this long for a TV show that's been on this long to do a movie version and something that's kind of so broadly popular. But we'll hear a little excerpt from the first Simpsons movie. We'll talk also about some of the independent films, not the things expected to be big blockbusters, which I know a lot of you in our audience are probably more interested in. And we can take your phone calls with your own summer movie picks, things that have been released just recently, perhaps, that you've seen and really liked. Or you can call and pan things, too, at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Give us a call. Chime in on the conversation with Dana Stevens from Slate.com, Owen Gleiberman from Entertainment Weekly. More movie clips, more summer movie preview to come. Stay with us.
In 2007, leaping his way onto the silver screen, the greatest hero in American history.
I forgot what I was supposed to say.
Excellent.
No, that wasn't a superhero of the webbed variety. It was Homer Simpson and one of the summer movies that we are previewing with Owen Gleiberman, film critic for Entertainment Weekly, and Dana Stevens, who reviews movies for Slate.com. And now we invite your on-air phone calls with your summer movie picks, anything you've seen recently. It could be a big Hollywood film. It could be a little indie that you want to turn people on to, whatever. Call us on the air. We will not ask you for money on the air at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Owen, after 400 episodes, there's finally a movie of The Simpsons. What took them?
Well, I'm not sure, but, you know, coming this late, they may be in an advantage. I think if they had tried to make a Simpsons movie when the show was really at its height, it might have been, well, what's the point? I mean, because it sort of is perfect at half-hour episodes. At this point, though, I think they have a chance to really revitalize and almost reinvent it a little bit for the big screen. I think the time is right for that.
Dana, you agree?
I can't wait for the Simpsons movie myself. I mean, I guess I have to agree with the general party line on the Simpsons that the show is no longer at its height, but even at its depth, it's one of the smartest and funniest and best shows ever on TV. And I've actually specifically stopped watching the new episodes of The Simpsons the last couple seasons for the sole reason that I want to make sure there's some Simpsons left when the show eventually ends that I haven't seen.
That you haven't seen in reruns because you watch every night at 7 o'clock?
Yeah, I feel like I've seen everything from the first, you know, whatever, 9 or so seasons, so I want to save a little bit to be fresh. So the movie sounds like a fun venture to me, and I like the fact that they're keeping such a tight lid on the story. Nobody has any idea what it's about.
And it comes out July 27th, so we won't know until a little before then when the critics like you get to see it. One movie out last week has relevance to New Yorkers for a very different reason. Waitress was directed and features the actor Adrian Shelley, who was tragically murdered last year before the film's release. Dana, does the film take on a new poignancy with that terrible event?
Yeah, I mean, Waitress, what can you say about that movie? It's a very hard movie to write about coming out at the moment that it does, because, you know, you don't want to say anything bad about this movie that was this woman put her heart and soul into right before she was brutally murdered. I don't think it's a great movie by any means, but it's so inseparable from that backstory that it's very, very moving to see, and has a very nice performance by Carrie Russell. And then in a, you know, sort of a related poignant moment that makes one think of Adrian Shelley, Hal Hartley has a new film, Fay Grim, that opens today with Parker Posey in the kind of role that Adrian Shelley might have played 10 years ago.
Let's hear a little audio clip from Waitress. And Dana, you wrote that the pies in the film are a shorthand to the plot. So let's hear about some of those metaphorical pies.
Pregnant, miserable, self-pity, and loser pie. Flambé, of course. I can't have no affair because it's wrong and I don't want Earl to kill me pie. Hold the banana.
I hate my husband pie.
I don't think we can write that on the menu board, hon.
Well, Owen, just from that audio clip, that sounds pretty fresh.
It's a very fresh movie, and I have to say, it really is impossible to watch Waitress without thinking about the tragedy of what happened to Adrian Shelley. At the same time, I think it is a wonderful movie that stands on its own. You know, when it first starts, you think you're watching a kind of genre movie, this sort of ya-ya sisterhood thing. It may remind you of the sitcom Alice. And yet I think within that kind of world, this movie keeps surprising you. And there's so much heart and soul to Carrie Russell's performance as this coffee shop waitress who should have everything going for her, but she becomes pregnant at the start of the movie, and she has this terrible husband. So it's really, there's a very downbeat side to it. It's a very soulful movie, very, very funny. I've seen it twice. It just grew on me even more the second time. I think it's actually a wonderful film.
Dana, you guys are not on the same page on Waitress, are you?
I think Waitress's whimsy felt a little bit clunky to me, and maybe I was so, you know, I was sort of so in the tragic mode of thinking about Adrian Shelley while watching it that I wasn't able to find it very funny. I did find the pies very appetizing and Carrie Russell full of charm.
Let's see what some of our listeners are going to see in the movies. Jim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Oh, hi, Brian. I love your show. I saw a film called Into Great Silence about a group of monks in a monastery in France. It's a small film. I saw it at the Quad, and I just loved it. I wanted to become a monk afterward, as long as I could bring my op-ed pages with me.
Is it a French film?
It's a French film, yeah.
Either of you see that?
Into Great Silence, I did see it. It's a fantastic documentary with a sort of almost a very meditative. It's like a meditative experience seeing the movie because it's essentially almost dialogue-free for, maybe the listener knows the length more than I, almost 3 hours.
Wow. All right, that's a nice listener pick.
So it's an anti-summer blockbuster if there ever was one.
That's right.
A beautiful movie.
Hadley in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Hadley.
Hi.
What'd you see?
I saw this amazing movie called The Great Happiness Space. It's / The Tale of an Osaka Love Thief.
And?
And it's amazing. It's this story about these host clubs in Osaka where these young men create these atmospheres for these young women to come and basically fulfill their fantasy, but it's much more psychological. It's about, what they're fundamentally missing in their lives and actually what they end up, how they end up supporting this obsession that they have, this relationship that they have with these men, is actually through prostitution. So it's like this, but it's an amazing story. It's
The Great Happiness Face Tale. Is it in Japanese?
No, it is in Japanese, but it's been translated, and it's not actually showing anywhere else, but I saw it at the Film Archives on 2nd and 2nd Avenue, and I don't know what the future is of
its run. But, okay, then another interesting indie tip. And Fred in Manhattan, you have something a little more mainstream here?
Yes. Two movies, they're going to be blockbusters, The Transformers and Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. Can't wait for those movies.
Which one? Oh, you're waiting for them. They're not out yet.
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah. More. All right, here's somebody, Melissa in Westfield, who wants to follow up on our critics' conversation about sequels which used to be failures, and as we were discussing earlier, sequels are more and more popular and more better done. But, Melissa, what do you think about that?
I think that I recently saw Spider-Man 3, and it seems like all of the sequels lately, the plot lines are so jam-packed that it forces you to rent the movie or buy it when it comes out on DVD and watch it more than once, and I just think maybe that's deliberate.
Yeah, so Dana, as she put it to our screener, it's the plottiness of sequels.
Well, yeah, Spider-Man 3 is particularly egregious in that respect. I think it has 4 villains, if you count the evil suit that takes over Spider-Man's body and another character's body as a villain. So, you know, you almost need some kind of a flowchart to follow the story of the movie. Then again, it's not the kind of movie where following every, filling in every plot hole is the most crucial thing.
I will say there's a real cop-out at the heart of Spider-Man 3, which is that the idea they had of Peter Parker getting in touch with his dark side is actually a pretty good idea. But I think they weren't willing to go with it. They turned it into a joke. I mean, you really felt the marketing executives hovering over that decision that, well, we have to make sure that he stays likable. And I think if they'd really gone with that and pushed it, probably the critics would have liked it better, and it might even be a bigger hit than it is.
Now, most of our listeners know the story of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped and killed when he was on assignment in Pakistan. Well, a new movie called A Mighty Heart, coming out later this summer, centers on the story of his wife, Mary Ann Pearl, who is played by Angelina Jolie. Let's hear an audio clip and get your reaction to that.
The day after 9/11, Danny and I flew to Pakistan. He was the South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, and I was working for French public radio.
Sorry, I'm so late. I'll call you.
Leave your phone off.
Okay. By the end of January, we were ready to go home. But there was one more interview that Danny wanted.
So, Dana, his life and his death were so filled with meaning. Does the film get there?
You know, I haven't seen the film yet, but I have to say that the casting of Angelina Jolie as Mary Ann Pearl turns me off a little bit. Not because I don't like Angelina, I do, but I feel like that maybe is a little bit of a recipe for injecting Hollywood bathos into this story. Then again, if anyone can pull this movie off, Michael Winterbottom can, the director who is really good at political thrillers and, you know, bringing politics into his movie in a less than ham-handed way, and who also made my absolute favorite movie from last year, the adaptation of Tristram Shandy that was so wonderful.
Yeah, he does documentaries as well, so he may be well-suited for this. This doesn't actually hit the theaters for another month. Owen?
Well, I'm very much looking forward to this film. I mean, hopefully it will remind people that Angelina Jolie actually started out as a very good actress before her life as a tabloid icon took that over. I think that what's interesting about this film is that it has the chance to be the first truly political movie about 9/11, the post 9/11 world. And what I'm wondering is, you know, how daring it's going to be. I mean, are they really going to get into some of the controversial aspects of why Daniel Pearl was chosen for this horrible assassination? And or are they going to make a sort of more tame, politically correct movie? I'm very interested to see that.
And Winterbottom's last documentary was The Road to Guantanamo, so maybe that's an indication that he's at least going to try. And it's not just feature films taking on weighty topics this summer. Owen, one film on your radar screen, I know, is the documentary No End in Sight about the Iraq War. Let's hear an audio clip from that.
Baghdad, a city of 6 million, has been under an 8 p.m. curfew since March of 2006. Over 3 million Iraqis have fled to neighboring countries. Estimates of the civilian death toll range as high as 600,000.
People who died, they're lucky. But people living, they're dead while they're alive.
Owen, you're looking forward to this, or did you see it already?
I saw this movie at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and it blew me away. It blew away everybody that I knew. And what's powerful about it is, you could sort of hear in that clip, it has a very factual orientation. It's not an ideological film. It's not really a liberal critique of the Iraq War, and in that sense, it's very different from most of the documentaries that have come out about it. It's simply a portrait of how the war was bungled, the planning from the very start, and they get a number of officials from the Bush administration, including people like Jay Garner, who was first put in charge of the operation there, to go on the record being highly critical of the administration. And I think an interesting thing about this movie is that it's so unideological that I could actually see conservatives cleaving onto it in order to say, yes, the decision to go into Iraq was a good one. The problem was all the planning and et cetera. Having said that, I think it is so well done, so well reported. It's a real piece of investigative journalism that I think it has a chance to be for Iraq what An Inconvenient Truth was for
really?
Global warming, a documentary that people just swarm to because it just electrifies the
Interesting.
Issue.
So No End in Sight coming out same day as The Simpsons movie, July 27th.
That's called counter-programming.
We'll see which gets the bigger box office. We're just about out of time, but Dana, just a little bit back on the indie beat here. There's that Irish movie out from Dublin that was a surprise hit at Sundance this year called Once. It's a musical of a different kind, and it's getting a lot of great reviews. And I know you're anticipating the Werner Herzog documentary-turned-feature film, Rescue Dawn. Can you squash this into 30 seconds?
Oh, well, you know, I'm just interested in the idea of Herzog going back and remaking his own documentary. He had a documentary 10 years ago called Little Dieter Wants to Fly, about a real-life incident of a U.S. Navy pilot who shot down in Vietnam, escapes, is tortured in a POW camp. It's a horrifying story, and he's now cast it with Christian Bale and Steven Zahn and made it into a fiction movie. So Herzog is always such an interesting guy. I like his documentaries better than his fiction films in general, but I'm definitely interested in this one.
And Once is a different kind of musical because the music is part of the story?
I'll bounce that one to Owen because I haven't seen Once. It wasn't at Sundance.
So. Once opens today, and it is a wonderful movie. I really urge everybody to go see it. It is a realistic musical. The songs are woven in. But it's such a touching story of these two people in Dublin who come together through the music they make together. And even though it's done in a realistic fashion, there are moments in this movie when you will absolutely swoon.
Owen Gleiberman from Entertainment Weekly, Dana Stevens from Slate.com. This has been really fun, and I think you certainly gave me a long list of movies that I now want to see that I didn't even know about. So I'm sure you gave a lot of our listeners that, too. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we continue our series on alternatives to the car for getting around New York City. But today we will ask, whatever happened to the jetpack? Stay tuned.